I think for those on Zoom, the camera has disappeared, but hopefully you can hear me and it will come back in due course. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not let them be afraid. Jesus' words to his disciples towards the end of John's Gospel sum up the proclamation of peace that permeates his story from birth to resurrection. Peace be with you, the risen Jesus had said to his shattered friends. Peace and goodwill to all people, sang the angels at his nativity. For he is our peace, declared the letter to the Ephesians. He has broken down the hostility between us, creating in himself one new humanity. And in him, according to Philippians, we have access to the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding. Well, you don't need me to spell out the painful, even grotesque, incongruity of this scriptural celebration of Christ's gift of peace in the face of the world as we know it. As I speak, terror and war are wreaking havoc in the Holy Land, in Gaza and Israel. While war in Ukraine, Sudan, and God knows where else grinds relentlessly on. There's violent unrest and merciless exploitation within nations, amidst communities, and against the natural world. Division is willfully fomented by those who profit from it, while fractured relationships within families lead to violence of every kind, from the terror of domestic abuse and femicide to psychological cruelty and emotional neglect. At times, it seems we are about as far from a state of peace as we can imagine. The Prince of Peace has come, so the Church proclaims, but really, what difference has he made? What then is the point of preparing to receive him more deeply and anew? Well, these are questions I'm suggesting we ponder this Advent season. So let's start from the beginning. The reading we just heard depicts the birth and naming of John the Baptist, whose vocation it is to prepare the way of the Lord. John's father, Zechariah, inspired by the Spirit of God, tells out the meaning of his newborn son in his great hymn of praise, beautifully read by Frank, which is known as the Benedictus. And it helps to be reminded, I think, that these events emerge out of an archetypal or an archetypical biblical backstory. You might remember that Zechariah is a priest of the temple in Jerusalem. Elizabeth, his wife, is also descended from a priestly family. And both are said to be righteous before God, living blamelessly in accordance with the law. But up till now, they've had no children because Elizabeth was barren and both were getting on in years. So you know what this signals. The scene is set for one of Scripture's miraculous conceptions and accompanying annunciations. As part of his priestly duties, Zechariah had entered the sanctuary of the Lord. He was there on his own, chosen by lot to offer incense while the whole assembly of the people was praying outside. Suddenly there appeared to him an angel of the Lord. When Zechariah saw the angel, he was terrified and fear overwhelmed him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard." Commentator Robert Tannehill remarks, apparently the barren couple had prayed for a son. But actually, it's not just about them. As Tannehill goes on, what is about to happen is God's response to a larger prayer also, a prayer for the fulfillment of God's promise to redeem the whole people of Israel. For, as the angel tells Zechariah, their child will turn many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God. And here we get our first inkling that his mission will have something to do with peace. Speaking of the yet-to-be-born John the Baptist, the angel goes on, with the spirit and power of Elijah, he will go before him to turn the hearts of parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. These words in Luke allude to the prophecy of Malachi in the 5th century before the Common Era, who had declared that before the Lord comes to his people, he will send the prophet Elijah. He will turn the hearts of parents to their children and the hearts of children to their parents, so that I will not come and strike the land with a curse. And Tannehill points out that where Malachi speaks of a mutual turning of parents to children and children to parents, Luke speaks only of the turning of literally the fathers to their children. This, he suggests, places primary responsibility for reconciliation on those who had power and authority in ancient society. But in any case, the theme of peace and reconciliation has been introduced. And when John is actually born, Zechariah makes it explicit. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways by the forgiveness of their sins, calling people to turn from that which separates and divides them. And when the Lord himself comes, so this gospel proclaims, he will guide our feet into the way of peace. New Testament scholar David Neville summarizes the point. According to Luke, peace is integral to the theological meaning and significance of the births of both John and Jesus. So, what is it about Jesus that enables peace in a new and distinctive way? Why do we need this dawn from on high, the advent of God among us, truly to know and practice peace? Well, this is the heart of the theme we'll explore in coming weeks. But for now, let me offer three touchstones to orient our reflections. The first concerns the nature of the peace of God. Michael Wood has said, there are lots of ways of making peace if we think of peace merely as the absence of immediate conflict. For example, we can make conflict go away in the short term by silencing, expelling, or killing those who disagree with us. But of course, this apparent peace, this cessation of disturbance, can only ever be temporary, because that which we violently exclude will inevitably fight back in a new form. And this is the tragedy we see playing out in Israel and Palestine today, where every supposed victory or suppression of violence only sows the seeds for future conflict. So peace that endures, lasting peace, or deep peace, cannot be defined merely as the cessation or avoidance of overt conflict. It has to do with right or restored relationships, It involves mutual accord and sharedness of life, where we do not live at each other's expense, but are lovingly committed to the good of all. In the language of the Ngunnawal people, I learnt recently, the word for peace is Naragunawali. It means aliveness, well-being, coming together. In the biblical vision, the word shalom also expresses a richly relational vision of peace. A peace which is liberating and uncoerced, marked by compassion, mutuality, joyful giving and receiving, reciprocal enrichment. Rowan Williams says, this is the peace Jesus creates between God and world and among the human family, because it's the kind of peace which exists between him and his Father. And this leads to my second touchstone. This rich peace, this shalom, Naragunawali, this we long and are made for. This is our truest humanity and our fullest life. And yet it seems at some level persistently elusive and even at times alien. To share in God's relational, compassionate, reciprocally enriching involvement asks something of us. William says it requires us to give up fantasies of control and invulnerability. It involves the willingness to be a part of the world, a moment in a pattern, dependent on others, others dependent on ourselves. It means the risk of response, decision, listening and answering, attending to a constantly shifting environment with the patience of attentive love. And none of this is easy. We are so often injured and afraid, so often faced with the hostility or violence of others, so often taught to see in terms of difference, division, entitlement, and threat. The divine culture of peace is not easy to live out in our world. And the light of Christ reveals the extent to which we are, like it or not, enmeshed in violence from which we cannot liberate ourselves. We need to be given a way. And this, finally, is what we're promised by the coming of Jesus. And note, it is a way. Not a steady state, not a once-for-all deposit of undisturbed tranquility, but a way of peace, a road to travel through all that has taken us out of peace, a practice that draws us ever more wholly into loving relationship with ourselves, with God, and with our fellow creatures. Advent invites us to prepare the way of the Lord. how we learn to follow where he leads will be our theme next week.